Paritaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavati Ashadashajayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad Gita Pavadveshinim. Mahatmanas tu mam paratha Daivim prakritim ashritaha Bhajanchananya manasaha Nyatva bhutadim avyayam Mahatmanah mam partha daivim prakritim ashritaha bhajanti ananya manasaha nyatva bhuta adim avyayam. So if you remember in verse 12, in the previous verse, we were talking about the Rakshasas and the Asuras. Mm-hmm. Means those who had a temperament that was really driven by rajas, and those who had a temperament, prakriti, you know, just as kind of a state of being that was really driven by tamas. And so these were the only two prakritis that were pointed out at this time, right, in this particular verse. And so he said, for such people, right, for them, moga asha, all of their hopes and even the punya that brought them to this birth, right, are in vain. They aren't going to fructify in anything lasting or meaningful. Or even the karmas. Karmas can be the rituals and all of the duties, the dharma that people would do. All of those are mogha. They're also useless and in vain. They won't result in anything lasting. Even if karmas and rituals are being done in order to gain, you know, a higher loka, you know, or a better next birth, all of those things are temporal. And so, again, aren't going to give you, in the end, what you're actually seeking for is an ananda or a fullness or a state of being that I can just relax. I can relax there. And I don't have this underlying conviction, true conviction, that whatever it is I'm experiencing is going to come to an end. Right? So any amount of ananda or fullness or joy or happiness or well-being that we experience, underlying it always is this knowledge. And it is a knowledge. It's a knowledge that we don't really like to bring into consciousness all the time, but it is a knowledge that this is temporal. And that knowledge of the temporary nature of my experience brings sorrow. Right? That's why the Buddha said, well, I always like what he says here, the Vedantin say this, and most people in these say this actually also the same thing, that sukha, pleasure, ananda is a dukkha yoni. It's just a womb for dukkha. Why? Because there's anything that's temporal that comes to an end, any sukha or ananda or well-being, what does it mean when that comes to an end for you? That's very disappointing, right? It brings about a disappointment or a dukkha or a sorrow. And so here in this verse, he says, those people who are bound by rajas and tamas, rajas means rajasic nature. Swamiji and Shankar also says a few things about this. Rajasic nature is really, I want this, I need this to be happy, and I'll basically do anything to get it. That's the key, miserable part of that. I want this, I need this, and whatever it takes for me to get it is what I will do. And the regard, I really don't take you into consideration in that drive. That's what rajas, in terms of desire. Tamas is much more laid back and slothful. Tamas is more like eat, drink, and be merry, as Swamiji says in his commentary. and I will eat and drink anything. Because Swamiji, you know, in India, of course, being a vegetarian is, for a Brahmin anyway, the idea of eating meat or eggs, or for Swamiji, it's even having something like garlic, is inconceivable. This is not food. It's not something that you would ever put in your mouth. And alcohol also, in the drink category, alcohol also is just a forbidden. It's just something that you absolutely don't do. And so when he's talking about this, he'll go on and on about it, because actually for Swamiji and for us, as we come to kind of mature in that particular area, I'd say it's an area of maturity, we also don't really want to eat meat. I mean, there's something, as you become more sensitive, or whatever you want to say, we're conditioned in the West to eat meat. Mm-hmm. And we grow up in that type of a culture. But when you really think about what's happening to the animals, for Swamiji, it's about ahimsa, non-injury. It's something that you start pulling away from more and more and more. You know? Even if you do it, you have to do it consciously with a prayer, because you're actually taking the life of another being when you don't need to do that. It's not necessary. Unless for some reason you think it's necessary, but usually it's not something that's necessary. And so he will talk about that forever. Because it's an issue for him. It's he comes from that culture, and he comes from a culture that values being a vegetarian. Especially, not all Indians are vegetarian, but the Brahmins are. And so they have a real sense of that. And we don't. I don't think we've grown up in that culture, and we don't have that same sensitivity. I won't tell you. It's too close. In satsang, I'll tell you when I have the tape on. What it is what Chuck told me, one of our students told me. He's been a vegetarian for many, many, many years. He raised his child as a vegetarian. And he made a comment about what it's like, so I'll tell you later. So anyway, with this verse is they're looking at, after they've spent, Krishna has spent really all of this time talking about his nature as Ishwara, and as Brahman, with the Maya Upadi, with the Prakriti, you know, with being Brahman with Maya Upadi. He's been talking about that. Now it's about, you know, people, what happens to people, you know, who don't know that and why they don't know it. And even the verse before, he says the people who are mudaha. People who are mudaha means they don't have knowledge, that ajnanam, that ignorance, hasn't been broken. And so if you're still in the state of ajnanam, you don't have self-knowledge, you are definitely mudaha. That means you're deluded. Deluded in the sense that your vision of reality is about the opposite of what reality actually is. Right? So that's what mudaha means. What's night to ajnani is day to an ajnani, and what's day to an ajnani is night to an ajnani. You know, that's the situation. Either I take myself to be the whole, or I'm an individual in it. Right? There's a big difference. Somebody who takes themselves to be the whole from somebody who takes themselves to be the individual within the whole, that's an incredible difference. You know, and how could you ever assume or take yourself to be the whole, right, without knowledge? You're not born into that situation. You're born, the beginningless of the cyclical creation is beginningless. The ajnanam is beginningless. You know, I use the example of, if you have an imagination of a meadow, for you, you're Ishwara of the meadow. You're a jnani, you're not mudaha. But if you're a character in your meadow imagination, you're muda. You're deluded, because you're looking around as yourself, totally identified with this physical body, and you're looking around in your imagined meadow as though this is the world, and I'm me, I'm in this world, and I'm subject to birth and death, and as is everybody else, you know, and I'm a part of the whole. Whereas if you're the one from whom the meadow imagination has come, you're not a part of the whole. You have no such idea. You are the whole. You are the whole, and you're everything in the whole also. So that's the kind of the night and day. Poor little person in the meadow doesn't have a chance. unless they happen to meet a meadow guru. You know, that can explain the whole thing. Right? So that's the situation here. So he's saying people who still have self-ignorance, they have no regard for me at all, this Avijananti. They have no regard for me at all. They don't even see me, the one who's abiding here in this physical body, in this human form. They don't notice me at all. And actually, I'm their very self, but I'm not recognized. What everybody is relating to is the physical form, the body, or the mind, or the sense organs, or the individual. They don't see the self. They don't see me in my true form. Not knowing my bhava, the param bhava, my real nature. They don't see me at all. They don't have any regard for me. But in fact, and from the standpoint of my true form, who I really am, you know, I'm actually the Lord of this whole thing. He goes, Bhuta Maheshwaram. I'm the Lord of the whole creation. Just like for you as an individual, you can say, I am the Lord of my meadow imagination. And you are. It comes from you. You imagine a meadow, right? Or you imagine an ocean scene. You're the Lord. You're the Ishwara of that imagination. It comes. You're the whole. And it comes from you, sustained by you, and resolves into you, both the nimitta and upadana karana. You're like the creator of it, you know, the efficient cause of it, and you're also the very material cause of it, both in terms of the very being that meadow imagination is enjoying, and of the material that allows for the projection, the maya itself. And so you are the Ishwara. That's clear from you. For you, you don't have any ajnanam, any ignorance covering you at all. In fact, for you, the maya, It's just the vikshepa. It's just the projection of the maya. There's no avarna there. Right? But for everybody within the imagination or within the dream, however you want to say, there's not only... You're part of the vikshepa. You're part of the projection with no knowledge of the substratum, of the conscious being that you are. You are that conscious being, but you have no knowledge of it. So that's a huge, huge difference. And so people that are bound by this delusion, just means everybody until they have self-knowledge. Mudra sounds a little derogatory, but you know, you're not only ignorant, you're deluded. But you have to understand that in the context of how they're speaking. So now, having said that, he said in this first verse, in this verse 12, you know, those people of the human beings who have this delusion, there's three types. Some that are predominant their predominant nature is rajas, or their predominant nature is tamas, which he said in this verse. But then there are people whose predominant nature is sattva, right? And he calls for those type of people who the prakriti, their bhava, or their very nature is sattva. He calls them daivam. Those people are diving, diving accusative. Their prakriti is diving, means that it's, Swamiji will say, it's in harmony with Ishwara, it's in harmony with the Lord. It means it reflects, and also diva. It comes from div, which means to shine. Sometimes we use that for consciousness. It reflects consciousness, it's brilliant. Such a mind has shanti, it's naturally peaceful, naturally dharmic, it follows dharma. It enjoys tejas, which means there's a really natural reflection of the self in the antakarana. So there's a sense in the antakarana, and the mind itself is a natural sense of wholeness and well-being. Just from there's a relative sense of wholeness and well-being because the mind enjoys a natural shanti. And so this type of person now is the type of person who can become, or who will become a mumukshu, who will become a seeker, who wants to know me. That's Krishna saying. So here he says, I'm talking about these people, he says, Mahatmanaha, so Mahatmanaha, Mam, Partha, He Partha, name for Arjuna. He says, Mahatmanaha, a nominative singer. These Mahatmas too. Two means whereas, as opposed to, you know, the Rakshasas and the Asuras types. These Mahatmas, so Mahatma, you know, it can mean, you know, if you want to just say a great souled one sometimes, or a great person, it's translated as in English translation. But Mahatma you know, if Swamiji's talking about it, or we're just using it within kind of a Vedantic context, it means really a sadhu. A sadhu means a person who is good. A person who is good means a person who has compassion, a person who practices ahimsa as a highest value. Ahimsa means non-injury, means for those people who's the most important, that ahimsa, in fact, just a little aside, for a person who takes sannyasa, who takes the orange, the primary vow for the person who takes sannyasa is called abhayam, fearlessness, freedom from fear. But the freedom from fear is this: let me not be afraid of anyone or anything, but let no person be afraid of me. Let no person, let no creature, let no thing fear me. So we can say, let no living creature, which goes beyond humans, this is where the vegetarianism and not picking plants comes in. Let no person, no creature fear me. That's the ahimsa. So it's a vow. It's, you know, it's a vow that's endlessly problematic. The Jains, you know, which was one of the very ancient traditions in India, who are strict Jains, will wear masks, gauze masks, so that they won't inhale any living creatures. So, and you can imagine what type of a tapas this is. They'll wear gauze masks so as not to inhale any living creatures. And they walk with a very delicate, you know, broom. Maybe you've seen these in India. You know, they're brooms that are, they're made of kind of a soft material, like soft, not straw, but something like feathery material comes down, and they'll hold it like this. Mm-hmm. And as they're walking, you know, they'll just swish from side to side. Like if you were walking and you saw a little ant there, you'd kind of blow it away or swish it away. They'll just naturally do that in case they might not see it, so they walk with that in front. That's an extreme of ahimsa, non-injury. But for us, though we might not go to that extreme, that can be a high value. You know, that we live a life of non-harm. We don't want to harm another person. And we do. But we make up for it. You know what I mean? It's not that you can be perfect at that, but that's the value. Ahimsa, non-injury, not to harm another person. And compassion, to try to help. So, in fact, I read what Swamiji said on this, and it's really kind of just a description of himself. Because he is always helping. He has the vritti to always help another person. It's endlessly just helping, and that's how he thinks. It's just wanting to help, wanting to care. It's a beautiful, beautiful quality, and not wanting to harm another being, even though other beings get hurt. But that's not the intent. The intent is one of non-injury, and so such a person who has that commitment, carries that commitment, whether you live up to it or not, you carry the commitment. And so when you don't live up to it, then you just pull yourself up and keep going and do it and try the next time. But that's your heart, one of compassion and non-injury, not wanting to hurt others. And such a person is considered a Mahatma. And so, as I was saying, so he said, Swamiji in his commentary went into the sannyasa, you know, a person who takes sannyasa. He didn't talk about this abhayam vow in his commentary this time, but this commitment to non-injury, not to hurt another person. And of course, the more we can live up to that, the more shanti we ourselves have, which is a wonderful thing. Sometimes I tell the story I always like, that Swamiji told many years ago, when he was a sadhu, but had been a sadhu for several years, we had telephones. He had a telephone in his room, and one of his devotees called him at about 3 a.m, you know, because something had happened. Something terrible had happened, and he was very upset about it. He just needed to talk to Swamiji. So he called. It's 3 a.m, you know, and so the phone's ringing, the Swamiji. I guess I'm, hello, you know. And so this the devotee said, "Oh, Swamiji, this is what happened," and told all the terrible problem that had happened and all this. And Swamiji listened, and he went through the whole thing. And then the phone call came to an end, and Swamiji hung it up. And then his next thought, he said, was that he felt so happy. He felt so happy because that he felt that of that abhayam, that this person was not afraid to call him at 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, think about that for yourself. Yeah, that they would be willing to call him at 3 a.m. Who would you be willing to call at 3 a.m? It speaks very well for that person, right? Because there's a, for the person that you would feel safe in calling like that. And so Swamiji felt that. It meant a lot to him. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of learn from these experiences. So anyway, so if this is just to kind of dilate this word Mahatma. So he says, Mahatmanaha mam eparta daivim prakritim ashritaha. These people have as their disposition, they're kind of dwelling in or abiding in this prakriti, this in their nature, a nature which is sattvic, daivim. They have this nature, which means they enjoy a natural relative state of compassion and relative state. They're not jnanis here, they're mamukshus, right? So relative state of compassion and dharma and shanti, and a relative state of peace. And he says, these people, bhajanti, they worship me, they're devoted to me, being ananya manasaha. Ananya manasaha means their mind doesn't go elsewhere. Their mind is devoted to me. I am what is primary in their life. And so that doesn't mean if you say, you know, their mind is ananya. Anya means other. Ananya, not another. Means their mind doesn't go anywhere else. Their mind is totally focused on me. It is devoted to me. I am its really its sole source of interest or source of commitment. But the meaning there is not that you spend your life sitting at attention, you know, staring at a picture of Bhagawan or something. It's that no matter what you're doing, the Lord is always there in your heart, in your mind, and it is primary. And Swamiji uses the example of, well, if I have a beloved, say my partner is my beloved, or I have a child, for instance, no matter what you're doing, that beloved one is always there, right? And is always taken into consideration. It's always there. It's not like you have to make time to remember that one. That one's an integrated part of your life. And so like that, this ananya manasaha, the one that Lord is Ishwar is an integrated part of your life. Integrated means it's everything you do, you know, is not away from that commitment, you know, and that relationship. So being ananya manasaha, where I'm the one who's really primary, you know, these people worship me. Nyatwa, having known, indeclinable past parcel, nyatwa, bhutari, bhutadim, avyayam, having known me, now me as Krishna's talking, having known me as Ishwara, now talking as Ishwara, as bhutadim. Bhutadim means that who was before all of the elements, before the manifestation of the creation, Adi, I came first, right? So even though the creation is cyclical, the one that is there prior to the manifestation of the creation is first. It's causal. It's the cause. So bhutadim is like saying, I am the one who is the cause of the entire creation. But then you can think, if I'm the cause, if I've become the cause of this, I've become all of this, then maybe I've gone through some sort of modification to become this creation. You know, I've turned into this creation like that. No, I'm avyayam. Means without undergoing any change at all on my part, I become this whole creation. This whole creation comes from me. I'm the cause of this whole creation, Bhuta Adim, and the cause of the whole creation, that which is first, that which is there before the creation. I'm the cause of the one from whom the whole creation comes, but as it comes, I myself undergo no change whatsoever. So that's why we have to use this dream analogy, or the meadow. You know, it's an extremely important drishtanta illustration that we use in Vedanta, because if you can understand the meadow imagination, or whatever imagination you may have, or the dream analogy, you can understand how a whole universe can come from you, just subjectively. A whole universe can come from you without your being, you going through any change whatsoever, right? Your consciousness undergoes no change. The conscious being that you are remains the same. And from that consciousness comes, using Maya, because the Maya, comes this incredible manifestation of whatever you want. That's the amazing thing. Whatever you can think of, whatever you can imagine, can have that without yourself going through any type of modification at all. So we use the imagination and use dream to make you really recognize the reality of that relationship between the conscious being that you are and this whole manifest creation. Because if you think of it, this entire manifest creation, you know, from the standpoint of what Krishna is saying, this entire manifest creation comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me, without me going through any modification, any type of change at all. Just like you get to be the Ishwara, you get to be the Lord of your imagination, right? From you, any imagination could come. You can imagine a universe. The universe comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you without you going through any change at all. It's just you are, that's your little piece of Maya. All of us being part of Maya get a little piece of Maya. And so you get to experience yourself as a baby Ishwara, right? But you're a baby Ishwara from our standpoint, looking at you. But from the standpoint of the creatures within your imagination or within the dream, you are Ishwara. Who are they going to pray to? Just think about it. If you imagine a meadow and put many people in the meadow, and one person is a mumukshu in the meadow, and they pray to you, Bhagavan, you know, please let me know. Who are you? What is this? What is the reality of this? Please help me. Who are they praying to? They're praying to you, because you're the Ishwara of the meadow. What do they need to know in the end? Is that they're the Ishwara of the meadow. They're praying to you initially, to the Ishwara, you as the Ishwara of the meadow, only to discover that they are the Ishwara of the meadow. That's the Mahavakya. That's the beauty of it. But it's easy for you as Ishwara to know that I'm Ishwara. It's a whole other thing for the character in the meadow to know I'm Ishwara. For the character in the meadow to know I'm Ishwara, there's a lot of teaching that has to go on there. There's a lot of viveka that is necessary, you know, for the character in the meadow to recognize that the conscious being that they are, really that they were, for the ahankara to land, the ahankara, the I, to land onto the atma, onto the self, instead of onto the upadhi, is a big thing. But if it lands through this drishtrisha viveka and these teaching methodologies that we use, what has to happen is that the character in the meadow needs to recognize that its very self is the self from which the whole meadow has come, and the whole meadow includes their body, mind, sense organs. And so that body, mind, sense organs, jiva in the meadow, really, that upadhi surrenders to the whole meadow Ishwara, because the jiva upadhi within the meadow, within the creation, is part and parcel of Ishwara, not separate from Ishwara at all. And the recognition is that the self that I am is the self which is Ishwara. The self, the conscious being, which is in fact Ishwara. You can say, I have to be able to say as a jnani, I have to be able to say I am Ishwara, not just I am Brahman. You have to understand that, because it's like, just think of the example we use of the wave ocean example. If the wave says, there's two things, there's little mistakes it can make. It can say, the wave can say, I am water. Right? That's good. It recognizes I am water. But it has to recognize, not enough. It's like saying, I am the Atma. Really, this jiva here, I'm a conscious being that is abiding without change, silently abiding, changelessly abiding. The conscious being that I am is changelessly abiding in this body. Mm. I am the Atma. Mm. Is that jnanam? It's step one. Step one. Right? Because at least that takes viveka. You've used some viveka to get there. The conscious being that I am is changeless, and I have a subject-object relationship with my mind and my sense organs and physical body. That's a wonderful thing. That's very, very helpful. Even that is helpful. But then there's a little farther to go. You have to recognize that the consciousness that you are, in fact, is the consciousness which is the self of all beings, right? That the Atma that I am is the self of all beings, is in fact Brahman, is in fact the self of all beings, is the self of the whole. And then what? Okay, so now I recognize that this conscious, the water, wave recognizes, okay, this water is the one water, you know, which is the self of the whole ocean, you know. But then we have the ocean. What is the ocean in reference, you know, what's the ocean in reference to the water? Is there water and ocean? It's a very interesting relationship. Do we have water and ocean? I wouldn't say so. But the ocean's there. The wave is there. But it's not and. You can't take the waves and the ocean away from the water. Right? So there really is nothing there but water, even though there's a wave and an ocean. That's the satya mitya. So with that understanding, then I can say I am the whole. Otherwise, I'm one vast amount of water, and then there's Ishwara on top of it. Or I'm a vast amount of water, and then there's this wave up here, an ocean up here somewhere. It has its own reality. There's no second reality like that, you know. And so that is knowledge, that I am the whole, that I am Ishwara. You can say, I am Brahman, I am Ishwara, I am the whole, but you have to be able to say all three. If you can say all three, you can say any one of them. That's fine. As long as you can say the other two, you don't have to. But if you can't say all three and know what all three means, it's not whole, it's not complete. Right? So we have to know that. That takes a lot of teaching. So now here, so that Buddha, this all came about because of this Buddha Din. I am the one who is the cause of the whole creation of all of this without myself undergoing any change. So now it says in this verse, Nyatwa, having known that. These are not talking about jnanis here, we're talking about mumukshu. So how do they know that? Because they have what we call Shraddha in the Shastra. Because the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, all of these texts talk about this being what Ishwara is. The one from whom the creation has come, is sustains it and resolves. Verse after verse after verse, all of the Upanishads have that same vision. The Bhagavad Gita, and even in the Itihasas and the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, there's so many little sections of knowledge in all of these texts. And so, for somebody who's born, raised in the Vedic culture, they will know who Ishwara is, but they haven't realized it. So they'll say, I know this is who Ishwara is. I know that because this is what all of the Vedas say, and I have Shraddha in that, you know. But I don't know it. I haven't realized the truth of that. That's why I seek out a teacher, because I want to realize the truth of that, even though I know that's what it is because the Vedas tell me so. So there's an indirect knowledge there. And so someone will have a mumukshu, or somebody within the Vedic culture who's now being described by Krishna as somebody who's, you know, seeking him, seeking this knowledge, seeking Ishwara, wanting to know Ishwara. There's a Shraddha, which we'll call, some people just translate it as faith. Swamiji will always say, faith pending understanding. Right? It's so you're not left there with the eternal faith, you know, or faith to find out. You have believe now, and then after death, you'll find out if it's true or not. Just have the faith now. But this isn't that. That's not what Shraddha means. There is such a thing as faith like that, which is not a type of faith which is not meant to resolve. You have faith that it's true, but there's no way really to know. You know, that's a different type of faith. That's not Shraddha. Shraddha means you have a faith pending understanding. You know, so say, for instance, you go to the teacher to gain this knowledge, which is all part of the tradition well known in India. So you'll go to the guru too, because you're ready. You want to know. You're mumukshu. Bhagawan is primary for you. Gaining that knowledge is primary for you. And so you're seeking a teacher in order to know. So you have Shraddha in the Vedas that Ishwar is there to be known. But you don't know. You can say what the Vedas say, but you don't know. And so you have Shraddha in the Vedas that they can teach you, they're meant to teach you, they will teach you through a teacher. So then that means you have to have Shraddha in the Vedas and the Upanishads and Shraddha in the particular teacher that you go to who's going to unfold those. So when they talk about Shraddha, it's always faith pending understanding in the teacher, right? And in the Shastra that the teacher is teaching. So you can always go, I do have that Shraddha, I do want to know that. This is what I want to know, but not from that teacher. That won't work, because your mind it just isn't available. It isn't available. Mind has to be available to learn. And then that Shraddha will resolve into knowledge. That's what they mean by Shraddha. So when he says, Nyatwa, Nyata, though saying Nyatwa means having, Nya means to know. Having known. So having known this, that Ishwara is the one from whom the whole creation comes, who is avyaya, changeless. Having known that implies Shraddha, because they don't have a teacher yet. Right? So how can you know something? You know something to be true, but now because of Shraddha, and you're committed, you believe that this is the truth, now you want to be taught. And that's what they're talking about. So having known that, having had that Shraddha, the mind is focused on me. Ishwara is my commitment. You know, that's where my love is. So worshipping me in that way, these Mahatmanaha, these people who have this degree of Antakarna Shuddhi, where for them Ahimsa, that Abhayam, that Ahimsa, that compassion is their highest value, you know. And that's, is their highest value. Do our best. That do our best part is really important. even though there's a beautiful, I keep wanting to relook up this verse, but when in the section where, it's either in chapter 2 or 3, where Krishna is really talking about karma yoga and antakarna shuddhi, and he talks about the karma yoga in terms of the Ishwara Arpanam Prati, you know, where everything I really do is, all of my actions are really for the sake of Bhagawan or for antakarna shuddhi, keeping as a worship of Bhagawan. So there's the whole karma yoga buddhi, but there's also what's called kaushalam, you know, these two aspects. And kaushalam is kind of a skill in action, like, somehow, sometimes I don't know what is the appropriate thing to do in a given situation. What is dharma? What is the dharma? What is the proper where to be? How to handle the situation properly? That kind of skill in action is what we call kaushalam. And then the karma yoga buddhi is where really everything I do is for the sake of antakarna shuddhi, for the sake of dharma, means for the sake of Ishwara. Then we can look at dharma as Ishwara. The dharma is the order in the creation, and that order is Ishwara. And so that devotion to dharma, that devotion to Ishwara, means I'm not working to get this thing so that I can be happy. That's not my primary motive. My primary motive is to do it in such a way that I'm in line with dharma and for the sake of antakarna shuddhi, so that I can have a mind that enjoys a natural shanti, so that this mind is available for gaining knowledge. That's what it is. That's what the current karma yoga is. But this kaushalam is also kind of a skill in action. So one in the commentary on gaining this shanta, this kind of shanti through karma, really the karma yoga buddhi, Shankara says, you have to have that samatvam. Means, you know, where I keep my equipoise, whether I'm successful in my actions or not. And then this commentary, Shankara says, even if it's that I'm not successful in keeping the samatvam, even in not being able to do that, you know, I have that samatvam. That's very, very nice, you know. That if that you understand that, you get rid of what, you know, years ago some students used to, that were in the first course up north, they used to, when they came out, they used to talk about the Vedanta stick. You know? That's the Vedanta, that absence of that samatva, you know? Like, it's okay, it doesn't make any difference, you just do better next time. That kind of, you know, that kind of permission to, you know, to pick yourself up and do better the next time. You know, that there's a lot of love and compassion in that, you know, and a lot of kind of encouragement. Like, just, it's kind of, I think Swamiji's even used this example, I certainly have. You know, if you're a little kid, say you have a little child, and the child is standing up for the first time and just starting to walk, and takes one, two, pop, plops down its little bottom, you know. And then what will it try to do, you know? Hopefully it'll just try to get up again and one, two, three, and it'll look around, be so happy, and then plop, right? But it keeps getting up, you know, until eventually it's just walking naturally, you know? So now the thing is with us as the parent of this little child, you know, what is our attitude? Is our attitude of one of encouragement? Oh, yeah, okay, about the two steps, that was beautiful, you know? One where you're just so pleased at their effort, you know, and so pleased that they're being able to pull themselves up and try again, you know? There's nothing in your heart that says, you fell after two steps. I hope it's not going to happen. You know, you don't want that kind of a parent, right? How could you fall after only two steps? Then they take three. How could you fall three steps? We can really, unfortunately, we can have this type of an internal voice, you know, that type of internal voice that if you're not living up to your expectations, that chattery is going on. Right? And so that's where that's what Shankara is talking about. You, that's where you need the samatvam. You know, that's where you need to be the good mother, you know, to the child inside who's trying. You know, as though you're trying to improve or to develop certain capacities in yourself or certain values like ahimsa or kindness or things that we values we all have, you know. But we're trying to improve, we're trying to grow, we're trying to expand ourselves with in those values, to mature, you know, emotional maturity, spiritual maturity. And so since we're at here and we want to be here, we're kind of working on, you know, developing those kind of type of qualities. But so what if you blow it? Like a little baby falling on its bottom, you know. So you're not able to do that, or you get angry, or this or that, like we all do. Then how do you treat yourself? Are you the good mother, or are you the bad mother? And bad mother means you. What does bad mother mean? Is that you don't create an environment where that child can love to grow. You know, it's not a supportive environment. So we need that internally, that to create that supportive environment. And often, that's not, we don't even know about it. We don't know about it because from childhood, you've grown up with an unsupportive environment in this way or that way or this way. And otherwise, we'd be in Swargaloka, right? You grew up with your little baby on. Everybody around you was cheering you on and, you know, and making everything absolutely perfect. Perfect response to you at all times. No. It's not Swargaloka. And so that means that, you know, from childhood, in many ways, there has been a failing in this way or that way or this way or that way. You know, and so often what happens is those failings get internalized. You know, and so we talk that way. We talk that way to our own mind. Whatever the failings are, on the positive also. Those are the inner voices that we have, and you don't even know that you have an inner voice and be chit-chatting away to you in a positive or negative way. it's really actually important to listen, you know, to listen to your own self-talk so that the mind itself is supported in its natural, very natural attempt to grow. In other words, your growth or to mature and to grow and all this, very, very natural. We're all continually trying to do that because that's who we really are. That's human. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the nature of Ishvara, really. Mm-hmm. So you're always trying to live up to that, but one thing is an obstacle or another thing is an obstacle. So how do you treat those obstacles? You want to treat the obstacles in a way, or the different hurts and things inside that stop that, in a way that they can grow. And if we don't, the problem is that we are kind of crippling the mind to be able to grow in that way. You know, just like if a little baby, you know, if you yelled at it because it couldn't stand up, it's probably not going to try to stand. It's probably going to just crawl off as quickly as it can into the corner. So anyway, this kind of the understanding of the whole process around Antakarana Shuddhi is so important, because that process itself gives shanti. The process itself, that samatvam, the way that you are towards your successes and failures, gives an underlying shanti to the mind, which is what we need and what we want in order to have a mind that can gain knowledge. Really, another little thing on this Antakarana Shuddhi, this whole idea of purity of mind. And you think it's a big word. You have to have a pure mind, you know. Gain knowledge, you have to have a pure mind. It's a very big word. It's a word that can be very weighty, in fact. But actually, when we're talking about Antakarana Shuddhi, is being able to learn how to be within the mind in such a way that it itself can enjoy a relative state of peace, a relative state of feeling cared for, of feeling loved, a relative shanti. Not absolute shanti. It's never going to gain absolute shanti because it itself is relative. But we can, through all of these various teachings of how to be with the mind and karma yoga and all of these things, and values, you know, all of the values that we practice and all of these things, it gives a relative state of peace, so that the mind is available for this knowledge. That's what it is. That's what Antakarana Shuddhi is about. It's not so that you're walking around, you know, in some Antakarana Shuddhi state. It isn't that, you know. It's that the mind has enough shanti to gain this knowledge. So, because when it gains this knowledge, the one who has the absolute shanti is yourself, is the Atma. There's never a time when, once you know, there's never a time that you will be away or removed from the absolute shanti of your being. And because it is absolute, and because it is changeless, as the mind gets to recognize you, to know you, to differentiate it from the waves, so to speak, of the mind, it has a home. You know, it has a self, which gives it, you know, the relative shanti with what which it is already enjoying, an absolute shanti which it's never away from. And so, in fact, the relative shanti becomes mithya, in fact. So the relative shanti is no longer as important as it was before, right? Because the relative shanti, or the relative agitation, has a self which is an absolute shanti that never comes and goes. That's what a person needs to recognize. We don't need a mind. Let's like this. You don't need to have a mind that is always like a placid ocean. That is not jnana. Just think of, that's not liberation. Liberation is quietening the ocean, you know, so that a wave never rises again. Right? That would be daunting and also far away from life. Right? But what is true, you know, is that what is true and what is liberating is the recognition of a liberated self, a self that is free, that is whole, that isn't subject to change, that you can't make better and you can't make worse. And it's that self that's always blessing and is the very water of the wave. It's the very, very self of the mind, but it's also free of the mind. And that's the self that gives peace to all of your experience. In the end, that's what it is. You recognize the one that gives peace to all experience. And the peace becomes mitya, and the experience becomes mitya. And the experience other than that very, the substance, your very being, becomes mitya. And if you don't like the quality of it, then you can, the quality of the mitya, you don't like the mitya emotion, you know, then you have learned how to handle that too and how to be with it in a way to bring some peace to it, you know. It's like if you say, if you don't like the wound on your arm, you don't like that wound on your arm. Well, why do you like the wound on your arm? Because it hurts. The wound hurts, you know. And I would rather, if I had a choice, not have that hurt. And so say I know what ointment to use and what method to use to help that hurt to heal. Then I definitely will do that, you know. Definitely do that. I'll take care of it. The same with the mind. Say the mind has some hurts or some problems. You can say it's all mitya, but I'd rather not be with that particular brand of mitya, you know. It doesn't mean that the shanti or the wholeness of your being has changed in any way. It isn't. But the mind is behaving in a way that has rough edges. You know, it's unnecessary. And so it will naturally want to, I would say, heal itself. The mind naturally wants to heal itself from its rough edges and to become a mahatma. When you're a mahatma, even the little glimpses we have of our own mahatmatvam, you know, our own state of being big, you're happy. You're happy with yourself then. You're happy with yourself talking relatively now, when you are compassionate, when you care about others, when, you know, when you're kind, you know. If you're being kind or compassionate, or you see a beautiful emotion like that arise from you, just like Swamiji, you'll say, oh, I'm so happy. You're happy about that, you know, because it's whole and complete and it's natural and it's in harmony with what feels true. It is what is true, but it also feels true. You know? What is true feels true. And so even relatively, I'm talking a compassionate or a kind gesture, or when a kind gesture is done to you, you may not know anything, you may not have knowledge, but that gives you an experience that feels true. Or I want this. I want to be like this. Okay, that's the mahatma. Okay, let's stop there. Okay. Om Purnamadam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.
I like very much that idea of wanting to have the sameness of mind, whether you know you're successful or not. And even in that endeavor, if you're not successful by having the sameness of mind,
yeah,
you're still okay.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's a really beautiful thing. That's kind of a psychology, you know. Even in ancient India and Shankara, there's a lot of psychology. Yeah. And that's one thing that, you know, where you go back even a step between how your own mind is treating you. You go back a step to be able to hold that also.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. because that gives you sameness of mind again.
It gives you sameness of mind, and it also gives you the confidence to try again. There's nobody ripping you down or hurting you. There's not a hurting voice.
Yeah. Why does that feel so good? Because
what would you rather have?
No, but it's helpful. I mean, it's part of the process. It's a process embedded in the process, kind of, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In the end, you know, as your mind settles down in this knowledge, the very nature of yourself, once it's differentiated from all of the emotions and the things that are going on in the mind, the very nature of yourself is what I call the inner friend. It's nice to have that when I use this word inner friend, where there's the way your buddhi really handles the mess. Does it handle it as a jnani or as a good parent or as an inner friend? Manas means, you know, the fluctuating mind and the emotions and whatnot. How does your buddhi, means your intellect or the observing witness, or whatever words you want to use, handle your emotional life? You know, handle your judgments or handle your hurts and pains. With what attitude? And so if it handles it as an inner friend or as the swami or as the good mother, then that one enjoys a shanti by its nature. And that shanti, you know, that shanti is not at odds with your very being, the nature of your being, of the self. And so as your mind gets more recognizes yourself more, its own self, really. You know, it's like the wave trying to recognize the water. All right. But it has to recognize that one, that me that is changeless. You recognize how beautiful and benign your being is. How much of a friend, in the sense of that your own being will never turn on you, will never judge you, will never reject you, is always positive. You know? There's not, the negative side isn't there. It's your very swarupa. And so you can have the buddhi going into conversation with different parts of the mind and complexes, which is very useful, because especially child parts in the unconscious, they need a mother, you know. They need a part that will talk to it and hold it and be kind. But there's also the reality that your own being is holding your mind all the time. That your mind always has that positive, silent presence, the presence of all is well with me. I always like to one way to really contemplate on your presence using an image is to use one of the murtis, like the Dakshinamurti at our temple, or even one a picture of the Buddha, or not picture, but these murtis, you know, of like a murti of Shiva or of Dakshinamurti, or there's so many, but you'll always, you know, see them. Maybe they're sitting in a meditative position with their eyes closed with that little half smile. Everybody know what I'm talking about? And so if you let yourself, when you're meditating, let your face and body take that position and put on that little half smile, what it does, you'll see, is that form is like a perfect image of your own nature. If you were to take your nature and put it in an image, that's the perfect image. And so what it will, that peaceful face with a little half smile. And so if you evoke, and in your body, if you evoke that image, the image evokes a recognition of yourself. And so it's useful, you know. It's any words we use also, like if you say I'm silence or I'm a sangha. These words are all, you know, I'm shanti or a sangoham and all of these things. They're anandoham. They're just words, you know. But if once the words have been taught, the meaning has been taught, then if you say the word, it resolves into you. But using an image, we don't always do that. But using that image can be so beautiful, you know. And why I'm bringing that up right now is because of recognizing the nature of yourself as being that inner friend who is whole and complete and totally non-judgmental and supportive, even though not doing anything, but they're words that you can say, yeah, totally full and whole and complete and non-judgmental and, you know, my best friend or whatever you want to say, the beloved, all of these things. But all of these words and that image of the deity are just meant to make you recognize that. Because once you recognize, then that's always with you. Because that's who you are. The problem is the mind's always lost in itself. It's lost in its own emotions and its own thoughts and what's going on out here. And that's where all of the focus is completely. Or focusing, you know, on the emotions themselves rather than let all of that turmoil, you know, be held by a presence, the presence of your being that's been differentiated from amidst all of that turmoil. So it has to be differentiated. This is all these teaching methodologies that have to be used so we can recognize that. So you just don't see yourself as whatever thought you are. Oh, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm this, I'm that. And that's it. It means I'm happy, means I'm happy. I'm sad, I'm sad. There's nothing else. You know? There's not you there who's very... in whose presence that happiness or sadness is taking place. So that differentiation you have to become clear on. It's not trying to create something from the outside, it's trying, you know, to help you see what's actually there. Yourself that's actually there. Not a self to aspire to having an experience of. It's a self to recognize right now. That's what I'm saying.
I was a little confused about when you said, when you were speaking about, you know, that we're a human being, that Shankara said, you know, like to have an attitude, behind an attitude. And then you said something like, because Ishwara is human.
Maybe that's when I was saying, I think I said that Ishwara is human.
No, maybe not, yeah. It's something like
that. But was I saying, was that when I was talking about the meadow and that every single part in the meadow is Ishwara? In other words, you are Ishwara. I mean, the body, you're Ishwara from the standpoint of saying I am the whole, but the body, mind, sense organs, and the rug, and the space, and the chair, and the desk are all Ishwara.
Yeah.
There's nothing here that isn't Ishwara.
Right,
but that's like saying, you know, my hand is part of my body, my leg is part of my body, my heart is part of my body, my hair is part of my body. None of this is away from my body, right? So like that I could say absolutely everything here, everything, sentient and insentient, are part and parcel of Ishwara. So Ishwara is the human being, Ishwara is the animal, Ishwara is the desk, Ishwara is everything.
I see, that's what you meant, yeah.
Yeah. That's why, you know, on Saturdays we're learning Rudram. Yeah. Rudram is so, it's so wonderful because it's always this namaha, you know, to everything that rishi, you know, in his, all of the experiences that I could just see him looking around, okay, namaha, namaha, namaha. You know, then everything he could think of and everyone he could think of, every situation he could think of, you know, my pranams to you, Lord, to Rudra, to Shiva, in this form, to you in this form, and to you in this form, and to you in this form. And he goes through all the polar opposites, all of the thieves and all of the murderers and all of the, everything you can imagine.
Right, and then the other one is, you know, I've listened to Swamiji's the morning meditations, because she taped it on there.
Yeah.
And he speaks about all this is Ishwara. It's a psychological order of Ishwara. There is the cellular order of Ishwara.
Yeah.
And then he goes and then he says, say it mentally. And then I go like, well, wasn't that one of the, the only ones who are supposed to do OM all the time, the renunciates, the sannyasis?
If you, it doesn't matter if you're saying OM, you know, a few times in a guided meditation, but say you use OM as your mantra, and then that just becomes like your japa, is you're just using OM. What he's saying, he's not telling you don't use OM, but what he is saying is that if you're a householder, or you need to be successful in the world and you need to make money, you know, and you need to manage in the world, OM is, by itself, is not the mantra to be using. Use it with something else. Because OM is a mantra that evokes total renunciation, you know. Like so here's an example. Say you're a householder and you have three children. You don't want to have the buddhi. You don't want to evoke the buddhi in you that wants to sit in a cave. You want to, it's not that you don't want to have knowledge, but you don't want to evoke that type of a desire to live the life of a renunciate. Whereas a sannyasi would want to repeat that mantra. So if you're ready for the lifestyle that it's evoking, then you can do it.
Well, I don't think I'm ready for the lifestyle, but I'm definitely getting a lot out of using that mantra in the sense of, because Swamiji says it symbolizes, it's useful to use a symbol.
That's right.
But then he does say Om Namah.
Om Namah Shivaya, or Om Namah. Om Namah. Om Namah.
And sometimes you use Govinda, something else. Yeah. Sometimes you use a Shiva.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You know, I get a lot out of it. I don't know. I mean, it keeps me very clear.
Well, I think that's for you to decide. That I've kind of explained what the territory is there.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody telling you not to do it. But if you have to understand what the territory is. Like if you want to use OM as your japa mantra, where you're, you know, doing the mantra, just saying OM, 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 you can do that. But why they tell people not to do it is because it evokes that renunciate buddhi. If you say, that's not a problem for me, I want to invoke that buddhi, then there's no problem with doing the mantra. But say you're living in the world and you have a lot of responsibilities and, you know, things to keep up, then don't you use OM by itself. Use OM, then he would give a mantra that has OM, like OM whatever. Ishaya, or, you know, Shivaya, Ramaya. But it's not something, it's not meant as a, like a prohibition. That's what I don't want you to think of it as a prohibition. Just want you to understand the difference, why he would say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if he says that in a meditation, it's because he's using OM as, you know, the symbol for Ishwara. And so you say OM, and then the manifestation of Ishwara, and then the resolution is all in there, that OM, you know. So he's using OM not in japa there, he's using it for nitta dhyasana.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm speaking about.
Yeah.
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 So the other day when I were discussing this with OM, and then I said that I had understood you to say that, you know, when a sannyasi or anyone, a teacher says OM,
mm-hmm.
the one thing that really, that OM signifies the entire creation, and significantly, that the means of knowledge will always be there.
That what?
The means of knowledge, whenever the creation arises, along with it, will be, or installed in it, would be the means of knowledge. So that when a sannyasi says OM, or a teacher, they're basically sort of saluting the means of knowledge, self-knowledge. I'm wrong. I know I've heard you say that.
Well, I think you're putting together a lot of different things I've said. So
okay.
One is that it is true that the creation as cyclical, it is viewed as containing this knowledge.
Yeah.
In other words, that the knowledge comes with Ishwara. It comes with the creation.
Mm.
It's not something that is man-made. They say it's a powder sham. Right? Because actually there's no means of knowledge among human beings that can take you to that conclusion. So they look at the Vedas as revealed knowledge and something that comes with the creation and is beginningless. Okay, so definitely true. Now, even within the Vedas, Om, the Omkara, called, they have a name for it, Pranava. It is considered the most sacred syllable. Right? And it goes throughout the Vedas, and so any prayer or chanting is always going to start with Om, and so in that way it's ubiquitous. It goes all the way through the Vedas as the most sacred syllable. So that's also true. Now, so that's those two things. Third thing is, when a jnani, a sannyasi, or not just sannyasi, any of us, you know, when you chant Om, or when you say Om, it has a meaning. Now, for a lot of people, they've just been exposed to the symbol, Om, and it's a beautiful symbol, and so they know that it's something special and that it's something sacred, you know. But they don't necessarily know what it means. They could say that the limit of the knowledge for Om could be, oh, it's a beautiful symbol, it's a sacred symbol, or it's a symbol that comes from India, or it's a religious symbol, or it's a sacred sound. They could say all of these things. They would not necessarily have any idea that the symbol Om is composed of these three letters, an A, U, M, and is something that's expanded upon and taught in the, you know, in the Mandukya Upanishad, and unfolded. And then unfolded to give you an understanding not only of Brahman, you know, the silence in which the Om takes place, but as, you know, the whole manifestation of the physical Virat and Hiranyagarbha, the physical manifestation, subtle Hiranyagarbha, and of the Ishwara, the Maya, and the Maya itself. They don't know that. But for you, or for somebody who's been taught, now for you, when you say Om, this word means something. And say you're using Om as a mantra for Nididhyasana, then you're saying Om, what is Om holding? It's holding everything, because the silence from which the sound Om arises is Brahman, right? And then the A-M-M is the manifestation, so Om, and then the A is the Virat, the whole creation comes, the U, where the mouth is a little more contracted, is Hiranyagarbha, and the M is the Avyakta, the unmanifest state, right? And so when you say Om, silence, Om, silence, then you recognize that the Om is taking place in silence. That is the symbol that holds everything. It's like the entire Vedas are in Om. Om is Ishwara. Om is everything. But for somebody, right, who knows that, Swamiji used to just say, you know, like if I say to you, his word was gagubuga, what does that evoke? Gagubuga. Let's do it. We can do a mantra, gagubuga, gagubuga. He's even done a mantra, pencil, 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 pencil. Which, you know, but say you have something like gagubugai. It doesn't evoke anything except, what does that mean? Probably. Right? What does that mean? You have to fill that sound with words. Well, Om is filled with the entire vision. So all of these things together. And Om is beginningless. This symbol, as the Vedas are, considered beginningless. No. But the whole Vedas collapse into Om. The whole teaching is in Om. If you know it. Om and Rudram. Rudram is considered one of the most sacred chants in the Veda.
So we need to do Mandukya.
Yeah, we do. Not yet, though. A few more things.
20 years on.
Yeah, when we're old.
When we can't make it up the stairs.
You know, we did do the Mandukya, and we did the... Were you with us then when we did the first Karika?
No.
Yeah, it's the second two Karikas to do. But now everybody, all those people are long gone. I'll have to start again. We'll do that pretty soon, not too long.
Rada, what do you mean by the Rudra? Do you mean the whole...
The Rudram that we're learning in class.
What you do in the temple in the mornings? That
Yeah.
That's a long one.
It's 7 minutes about Rudra. It's what we're learning in on Saturdays.
A lot of repetition.
Yeah, we're on the fourth Anuvaka now. Going into the fifth, right? It's wonderful, though. Yeah. For Antakarna Shuddhi and everything, it's... Especially if you're studying the meaning.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful. Yeah.
You know, I chant and listen in the morning when I'm walking my dog, and the last line of the fourth Anuvaka is the dog. And
yeah.
The dog orders.
That's so sweet. Yeah.
Do you have it in English?
Huh?
Do you have it in English now?
No.
No, but you just remember what the meaning is.
Yeah, you have to study the meaning over and over so that eventually as you chant it, you know what it means. Mm. Yeah. That's why Swamiji's book's so good. You know, to use...
That little blue one?
Yeah, the blue one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. it's a task,
you know what I mean?
To memorize
guy, root. You know, it's like three sentences and I'll work it to death. You know what I mean? That's enough for me.
It's a big deal to learn Rudram and then to know, be able to know what it means when you're chanting it. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, in India they grow up memorizing, but we don't grow up with that.
No.
Yeah, but it's a wonderful, I think it's just a wonderful habit to get into, to keep working on memorizing, especially verses and things like that. It's good for the mind. Feels good too. To memorize something, remember it. And if you study Sanskrit, you have to memorize. Otherwise, you have a lot of charts around you. Mm. Until finally you say, I can't find it. Too many charts, I can't find the chart. You have to memorize.
Don't forget the
Vedanta. Maybe I should pray for that.
Don't forget the Vedanta stick.
Yeah, no, I have two of them.
And the kind mother.
Yeah, the what?
The kind mother.
Yeah, yeah.
That I have.
I was thinking when you said that about the sort of like an infinite regress, you know, of kindness in a way. You know what I mean? There's one place where maybe infinite regress would be useful.
Except, you know, what is really beautiful, though, is that it's not infinite regress because it stops at the self.
Yeah.
The source of it is the self.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's why at some point the words go away and yourself is there taking over that.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
That's because that's the natural stance of your being. You know, without change or words, just being, your being itself is that.
I have a question. We say that the laws are Ishvara. But when it comes to Maya or Mithya, the laws are also Mithya. They're part of...
Ishvara is also Mithya if you're talking about the names and forms. Right? The only thing that's not mithya is the self. It's like saying the only thing that's not mithya is the water. The waves are mithya, the ocean is mithya. But what's really there is just water. So that way we can say this whole creation, whether we look at the whole as Ishvara, you know, where the whole creation in a sense has the sense of self. But that is mithya. And everything in it is mithya, but what is true is this: is the self, which is its very being. You know, satyam mithya. This is the thing with satyam mithya. You have to be able to say, like say with the mind. The mind has to be able to say, "I am the self." It's like the wave saying, "I am the water." But then you also have to be able to say, "But the water is free of the wave. The wave is the water." The water is free of the wave. I have to be able to say, my mind is me, is the self, but I am free of the mind. That's the trick, because if you don't understand that satya-mitya relationship, it's like, oh, I've got body and my mind and my sense organs, and then there's the self over here, you know? Mm-hmm. That there's some sort of distance or something. And now I have to make my mind just perfect reflection so that somehow it can see the self, or so all kinds of unfortunate things go on. But there, you are the self. But the problem is that the body, mind, sense organs is taken to be it and the self it. See, it has to be. What if you say this is the ajnanam? Your body says, your mind says, I am the self and the self is me. I am the self. The mind says, I, the mind, am the self, and the self is the mind. Right? I am the mind, and the mind is me. Right? They don't even think to know that they have to say it both ways. They're not going to say that. They're just going, I'm the mind. What are you talking about? I'm the mind. I am my mind. Or I'm my mind body. That's who I am. But what we need to be able to say is, yeah, this mind body is me. So that's right. But I am free of it. So it depends totally on me. I am itself. Because otherwise you're looking for a self. The mind is looking for itself, a self, because it's different than the self is different than me, the mind. But no, the me of the mind is Brahman, actually. The very me of the mind is Brahman. But the mind takes the me of the mind to be the mind, you know, not to realize that the me of the mind is the me of the whole, is the self of the whole. That's satyamitya.
Well, I get confused though, you know, when we talk about devotion to Ishvara and so many things. But
who's devoted. That's like, you know, the one who's devoted is not from the level of Atma, it's from the level of this body, mind, sense organs that is limited within the whole. And so you have, you know, like limited intelligence, limited capacity that is held by limitless intelligence, limitless capacity. You know? And a mind that itself by nature is limited. You know, held by a mind that is limitless, that type of thing. So the devotion comes between the individual and the total, the jiva and Ishvara. But in part of that understanding, the self of the jiva is the self of Ishvara.
It's a different level.
Different level. Let's stop. We're done.